Welcome to episode 49 of Stories from the VO Booth. I'm your host, voiceover talent and trainer, Tina Zaremba. Okay, today's guest? He's a legend, folks. He's a legend in the VO industry and in his own right. His illustrious career spans over 30 years. He's voiced numerous characters in animated series, Inspector Gadget, The Tick, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, just to name a few. And as I discovered from our chat, he's truly a good human being. Listen in as the remarkable Townsend Coleman shares how his father's dreams influenced his path, as well as a play he saw in grade school. The voiceover talent that he so admired and his chance encounter with said talent, what his DJ name was when he worked in radio, how long that DJ name lasted for, and where he found he really lit up in voiceovers, and way more. Here's our chat.
Townsend, tell me, thank you so much, first of all, for taking the time to chat with me. I know you're a busy guy.
Of course.
So I guess I want to start off with, how did you find voiceovers?
Well,
or did it find you?
Yeah, well, kind of, sort of. I think I probably sought it out, but I think largely it was in my blood because it's what my dad always wanted to do. You know, and my folks met working at NBC in New York at 30 Rock in the early 50s.
Yeah.
And my dad wanted to be an announcer for the network, and it never worked out for him.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was a year, he was the manager of the page department, you know, the tour division. And in 1955, when I was a year old, he just got fed up with Manhattan and moved us out to Denver.
Oh, beautiful.
And yeah, and he got a job on the radio, and which is really what he wanted to do. You know, he wanted to talk somehow, you know, to people. And so got a job on the radio. And I remember as a little kid, you know, my dad was always listening to comedy albums and old radio dramas on tape and stuff. I mean, I remember as a little kid, he had scavenged a huge reel-to-reel machine that NBC was pitching. They're throwing it out because they were redoing their whole radio setup.
Right.
And so he scavenged this thing, rebuilt it. And I remember growing up with this enormous aluminum deck, you know, with the big 10-inch reels and stuff. So my dad used to record us, my sisters and I, when we were little. And so I was always kind of aware of radio and aware of voices and aware of radio drama. And so even as a little kid, And I remember in fourth grade, I decided I wanted to be an actor. I saw a school play that blew me away, a version of Peter Pan. And I said, that's what I want to do. And so it's always been percolating within me. Well, then cut to doing high school theater. And then when I went to the University of Colorado in Boulder in 1972, and I wanted to be a theater major, and my mom wouldn't let me. She said, you got to go study something you can get a job in. So the next thing only other thing I could think of was architecture, because I've always been sort of artistic, and I love that stuff and drafting. So I got into their architecture school, and that lasted about 2 minutes. And I ended up just spending all my time over at the radio studio and at the theater anyway, and in my second semester of my freshman year, I auditioned for and got the lead in the university production, which was pretty controversial back then. Maybe it would be now too, because, you know, in university theater departments, there's a real hierarchy. You know, when you're a freshman, you just do the grunt work. And then maybe when you're a sophomore, you get a better role. And then, you know, as a junior and a senior, that's when you audition for the leads. Well, I got the lead to this show. And
what show was it?
It was called Life is a Dream. It's a Spanish Baroque style play by Calderón de la Barca. And it was really a lovely play. And so I played the lead in this thing and just had the time of my life. And it was exactly what I wanted to do. Well, I ended up quitting school for a bunch of reasons and only going for 3 semesters there. Got married early and was working some terrible jobs that I just hated. And I got a call from my brother-in-law, who was working at a radio station as a news guy in Cleveland, where I grew up. And he said, hey, we're all getting fired. They're changing formats. They're going to this beautiful music format. and they're going to be hiring inexperienced people cheap. I know you're interested in radio. You should go down and talk to this guy. And so I did. And he hired me. I'd never been on the radio before, but he hired me to do weekends, midnight to six. So I was doing the graveyard shift. And then they hired me full time. And, you know, it was, there's nothing creative about it. You know, you're just doing time and temperature and reading PSAs on the quarter hours, you know, between midnight and six. But I was on the radio. And so it was like somehow I was living my dream, you know, and it just happened. Well, they fired me after about a year. So I couldn't have been so great, because getting fired from a beautiful music radio station takes a lot of hard work. But I ended up over in 1976 at a disco station in Cleveland called Disco 92. They hired me the graveyard shift also. And I worked that. And it was the first station where I had to come up with a DJ name. Because Townsend Coleman, I figured Townsend Coleman was never going to be a name on the radio. And my full name is Townsend Putnam Coleman, and I'm the third. And when my dad was on the radio in Denver, he was a news guy, and he changed his name to Thomas Peter Cochran because he wanted to use the same initials. So I thought, you know what? I've got to be a personality on this station. I'm gonna go use the name Tom Cochran as sort of an homage to my dad. And I got about 2-3 hours into my shift, you know, and was just stumbling over the name like crazy because it was so foreign to me. Plus, I was nervous as all get out, you know, being on the radio for real, you know, spinning DJ disco tunes. And finally, about 3 a.m, my PD hotlines me and he says, you know what, dude? Just use your real name. That name is just not working. You just can't seem to spit it out. And I said, are you serious? And he said, yeah, just use your real name. I said, but I'm okay. So the next break I go on and now I'm Townsend Coleman instead of Tom Cochran. And so whoever might have been listening, you know, to that show go, what in the world? It's the same voice, but it's a different, he's got a different name now. So anyway, so I got into radio is the long answer to your question. And it was going sort of from one radio station to another that I discovered they were having me do voice commercials for the radio stations that I was at, you know, and then I ended up being a production director at one of them back up in Cleveland and loved the production aspect of it, loved the voicing of the commercials. And I discovered that there were ad agencies in Cleveland, you know, and this is in the mid 70s, that wanted to hire me to do commercials for, you know, the May Company and department stores and car dealerships and stuff. And we're going to pay me. And that there was this union called AFTRA that said I had to get paid X number of dollars. And it could go toward my insurance and toward my pension and stuff like that. And I thought, this is crazy. I love this. So I put together my first genuine demo and shopped it around to the ad agencies in Cleveland. And I started getting a lot of work. And finally, it got to the point where I was making more money a year doing my freelance voiceover stuff than I was making working 6 days a week at the radio stations.
In Ohio? Or was that when you were in California?
Wow. In Ohio, yeah. Because I did 10 years on the radio in Cleveland. And then by the end of that, in, you know, 82, 83, 84, I was making more money a year doing the freelance voiceover stuff than I was working 6 days a week on the radio. So it finally became a no-brainer for me when I went in to ask for a raise at one point, this last station I was at, and they just wouldn't even talk about it. And I said, well, you know what, then I'm done. And he said, whoa, wait a second. I said, nah, you showed your cards. I'm done. And I stuck to it and I quit radio. I was going to just freelance around the Cleveland, you know, Pittsburgh, the Midwest area. And then all of a sudden after quit radio, maybe about a couple of weeks later, I got notice from my landlord that they were selling the house we were living in. And we had to be out. This was in June, July of 84. We had to be out by the end of September. Well, I had 3 kids at the time. Mm-hmm. And so I had to be settled someplace before school started. And that gave me like 6 weeks. And I thought, man, what do I do? And I thought, I've always wanted to go, because I was doing a lot of theater at the time too, and musicals and stuff. And I was modeling. I mean, I was doing everything that I could think to do in Cleveland that had anything to do with the entertainment industry. And I was hosting a nationally syndicated dance show at the time.
I saw that clip.
It was pretty nuts. It was a pretty heady time, you know, for a Cleveland boy. And so I'd always wanted to go either to New York or L.A. And I had some friends who said, you know what, you belong in L.A. And so I came out after the Olympics in 84, looked for a little place to live, found one in Glendale, and 2 weeks later, we were living here. It's like, boom, boom, it happened that fast.
And then the opportunities, did they just start coming in right away?
You know, I got really lucky because I knew one person out here, and she got me in an interview over at her agency, which I went and interviewed like my second week here. Mm-hmm. And then I got an interview at another agency. And basically, the two agencies were Special Artists, where she was, and then SBV, where her husband was. And so I went and talked to Rita Venari, and Rita was really gracious and sweet and, I guess, like my stuff. But she said, you know what? I've got some guys who are too similar to you. I would love to take you, but I can't. Mm-hmm. And I understood that. Well, it turned out that the two guys were Rob Paulsen and Cam Clark. Mm-hmm. So, you know, who are some of my best friends now. You know, I've known them forever. But I ended up over at Special Artists because Jeff Danis, who was the new voiceover agent there at the time, he'd only been there a month or two, I think. He listened to my tape that I left. And by the time I got home from that interview with the on-camera agent, he'd already listened to it. He wasn't there when I got there, but came in after I'd left and listened to the tape, called and left a message on my answering machine, which I got on my way home. When I got home, I listened to this message. He says, whatever you do, I listen to your tape. I love it. Don't sign with anybody until you come and talk to me. And so I thought, well, all right. So I went and talked to him the next day and ended up just signing with them. And they were really hungry. I was really hungry. And things just started happening. They were thrown. I mean, it didn't happen right away. But relatively speaking, it did. Because 6 months later, I did my first little part in a movie. This all within 10 days. I did a part in a movie with Tommy Lee Jones. I got my first cartoon series, which was Inspector Gadget.
Love it. Yeah.
And then I did my first on-camera national network TV spot. And I thought, wow, this is crazy. I've made it. You know, and then, of course, by Christmas of that year, all the money that I'd made during that summer dried up. And I couldn't pay my rent and had to sell a car and borrow some money from my mom, you know. So that was a lesson learned for sure. But during that time, that Inspector Gadget thing really turned things around for me, because I said, wow, I didn't even know this existed. And here I'm in a studio with Maurice LaMarche, Frank Welker, and Don Adams, and me. And I'm going, yeah, I kind of like this, you know, send me out of more of these kinds of things. So I got in over at Hanna-Barbera and was in at Deke and, you know, just started doing animation and auditioning for shows and getting these series. And that's where I found I really lit up. And then the promo thing didn't come. And then I was doing a lot of commercial work too, and just started getting some great accounts like Sunny Delight and Home Depot and Taco Bell and things like this. Yeah. And then in 1993, I had auditioned in August for a show called The Tick, which I ended up getting. And a week later, was standing in Jeff's office, and he got a call from a guy over at NBC saying, I'm looking for a certain type of, you know, guy for this thing we're starting called Must See TV. And Jeff said, well, I've got your guy right here. You know, let me put him on the phone. And I'm like, wow, wow, wow. So he hands the phone to me and says, "This talk to this guy from NBC and just, you know, do this particular style." And so I did it for him. And he said, wow, that sounds great. Can you come over here and try it on a promo? And I said, yeah. When? And he said, well, can you come over this afternoon? Like now? And I said, you bet. And so I headed over from ICM over to Burbank and, you know, went down to the basement down there in the production studio, and they were waiting for me. And you got to understand that it was surreal for me because A, it was NBC where my folks met.
So what did that feel like to fulfill your father's dream?
Well, it was
becoming an announcer for NBC.
Yeah. It was really bizarre. It was like this weird sort of coming full circle, but not trying. It's not like I was, because I, as much as I ended up loving doing animation. I didn't come out here thinking I was going to do animation. I was not one of these kids that grew up thinking I want to do cartoon voices. It just wasn't my thing. You know, Right. Well, it was the same with promos. This was back in the day when you had Ernie Anderson and Chuck Riley and Danny Dark and these guys with these amazing voices. Well, that wasn't me. So promos, like animation, weren't on my radar. So the other thing was, it was bizarre for me thinking, wow, this is NBC. It's like, I feel so familiar with this network, even though I've never worked there. But I remember it as a kid going back at like 9 years old with my dad. He took us back from Denver to New York City at one point, and he wanted me to go meet his boss. And because we had the same name, what he wanted to do was, he told the receptionist, tell him Townie Coleman is here to see him. And so the gentleman said, yeah, bring him in. And so my dad sent me in and said, you say, hello, Mr. So-and-so. And, you know, it's good to see you again. And so I did that. You know, I mean, I've got all these memories of NBC in New York when I was a little kid. So to be back at NBC in Burbank for a completely different reason was bizarre and surreal to begin with. But the other thing is that I was a huge, huge fan of Danny Dark. I used to, when I was a production director in Cleveland, and I would rack up the spots that came in from him for Chevrolet or Anheuser-Busch or any of these spots that he voiced, I'd be like, who is this guy? And when I found out who he was and became a big fan of his and looked up everything I could find about him, when I first moved out to LA, one of my early jobs was as a Keebler Elf. And Danny was the announcer at the end of the Keebler spots. That was a long-running campaign for him. And I remember going to that session over at LA Studios thinking, I wonder if I'm going to get a chance to meet Danny Dark. I wonder if he's going to be at this session. And so we showed up, and it was just a couple of guys who were doing elf voices and Parley Bear, who was Ernie the elf. And that was a trip meeting him, and no Danny. And so I'm thinking, oh, darn, you know, I guess I'm not going to get a chance to meet him. And then as we're signing our contracts and we're about to go, Danny walks in the door, and I knew who he was. And I was so starstruck. Yeah, I mean, I really was. I was like, but I thought, I've got to meet this guy. So I just went over to him. I said, Danny, I'm just a huge fan of yours. And my name's Townsend Coleman, yada, yada. And he was really gracious and, you know, really pleasant. And but when he opened his mouth and that voice fell out, I was like, oh my God, that's him. And so Danny had been the voice of NBC for, I don't know, 12, 13 years at that point. So when I went in to do that audition, I saw that chair at the microphone and I knew that's Danny's chair and that's Danny's mic and those are Danny's headphones and that's Danny's volume knob. I mean, this is all Danny's stuff. So I was completely intimidated by that. And I had to really kind of mentally work myself past that and just say, you know what? Danny does his thing and he will forever. And he'll always be Danny Dark. They're just looking for something different. And it looks like it's just a short-lived campaign here. And so we just forge ahead. So I listened to what they were asking for, which is what I auditioned for over the phone. And we played with that and it was a little too down. Mm-hmm. But we messed around with it for 15, 20 minutes. We made some adjustments. They liked what they got and they put it on the air that night. It was one of the very first must-see TV promos. So then it was launching the John Larroquette show, I remember. So this is a week after I got the tick. I did this, ended up at NBC, and then they called me back the next week and I did their Tuesday night thing. And then the next week I did their Tuesday night lineup. In addition to the Larroquette show, I did some other shows. And it was like they just sort of kept throwing me a few more, you know, crumbs, bones each time they brought me in. And that went on for a couple of months. And then about 3 months later or 4 months later on Halloween weekend, they called me at home and said, we want you to do the Tonight Show promos.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, it was nuts. It was crazy. And so I started doing the Tonight Show promos the following Monday on the 1st of November. It was only supposed to last 5 weeks for the November sweeps. And they were working so well for Leno because he had been getting his butt kicked by Letterman at that point. Mm-hmm. And they were working so well at the end of the 5 weeks, at the end of sweeps, they just never told us to stop. And so we just kept going. And that gig lasted 16 years for me. You know, I mean, yeah, I mean, beautiful. I ended up doing all the comedy. I mean, they just kept throwing more and more of the primetime comedy stuff my way. And then, you know, so I ended up doing Seinfeld and Frasier and launching Friends and you know, all the way through 30 Rock and The Office and Community. And it was the best job I ever had. It was the best job I ever had. And my dad, who was living in Florida at the time, of course, he was super proud, but he came out a few times to visit. And I got a chance to take him down there and watch me do my NBC stuff. And I'm just beaming with pride. And the lovely thing about that was that it was not like my dad was jealous or envious of me or somehow upset that I got to do it and he didn't. That wasn't in him. It was like I was fulfilling his dream and he was living vicariously through it. And it was just...
Oh my God. So I have so many questions. So let me ask stepped back and looked at your career and gone, how did this all unfold? What was it? Because when I listen to you, I feel like A, talent, B, timing, right, and drive. I don't know if I believe in luck. I believe that everything is, you know, meant to be in some ways. So when you look back at that, what do you think helped orchestrate that for you, those experiences?
Tina, I really can't answer that because I still, to this day, look back. You know, it's like when I get together with Rob and Cam and Barry, and we put together these silly little videos, you know, for fans and stuff. I look at these guys and I think, I look back on that audition for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and think none of us at that time thought anything of it. It was just another gig for a weird sounding show. But we happened to get it and it happened to turn into what it did. And, you know, I mean, there isn't a day that goes by that I don't look back and go, how did this happen? Because I don't think it could happen today. But who knows? I mean, it was a combination of the time in this business, you know, the era that it was. The talent pool was way smaller back then, because back then you had to be in LA to do animation, you know, to basically do promos. If you're going to do network promos, you had to be in New York or LA. And the entertainment part of the promo world was in LA, and the news and sports part of network promo was basically in New York, you know, and it was also back when you just had just a couple of networks. You know, we only had 3-4 networks at the time. Well, now you got a million of them, and and technology allows anybody to be doing voiceover from their closet, like me. You know, I'm sitting here in my closet. I mean, I don't even have a vocal booth or anything fancy. I'm just sitting in my closet with a mic and some gear.
Well, that's your closet I'm looking at? People aren't going to be able to see this. That's a big closet.
It's a walk-in closet. But if I were to turn my computer around and show you that all my clothes are hanging there, all my crap is up on the shelf, that entire shelf is about 500 pairs of shoes. You know, these are file cabinets back here and stuff. But it's just, it's just my closet. So nothing fancy, and technologically anybody can do it from anywhere in the world. And we've got easy ways of connecting, like you and I right now are on Zoom. I do my work every day on IPDTL. It's super easy to do. And now, of course, with the internet, everybody can see how people are doing things. So voiceover has become a thing now that people are aware of.
So how do you stay relevant? How do you stay relevant with this then?
You just got to keep hammering away at it. I don't have any, you know, magic answers. I try and stay relevant by just continuing to audition. You know, I don't book like I used to. Most of my contemporaries would say exactly the same thing. I don't know anybody who's booking the way we used to, you know, but you either keep stepping up to the plate and taking those swings and hoping for a hit, or you decide that you're done with the game and you go do something else. As far as staying relevant, listen, Tina, the whole social media thing has become seemingly so important to a person's career, whether you're on camera or even voiceover or whatever. You know, you've got these influences on Instagram and YouTube and all over the place. I hate to say it, but that is just not me. That's just not me. I'm not going to go do that. You know, I'm 64 years old. I've been, you know, blessed with a really great career. Right. I'm just, you know, I leave that to the kids. And they can, you know, if that's the way they've got to play the game these days, and that's the way they're going to play it, I probably won't, you know. And so I just continue to do what I am used to doing and like doing. And that is, I'll audition, I'll send it out there. But I'll be honest with you, when I send these auditions back to the agency now, you know, and I hear that whoosh on my computer email going, to me, that just feels, it doesn't feel like it's my MP3 going back to my agent. It feels like it's my voice going out into the ether, never to be heard. That's what it feels like. And so what I have to do is I have to continually keep myself up to just stay in the game, to even want to step up to the mic and take another swing, you know, but take another crack, take another take. You know, no magic answers. You just attitude, I think, is everything, because you got to stay positive. If you start allowing, you know, depression and anxiety and fear set in, those things will eat you alive. And you were at VoiceOver Atlanta, so I presume you saw that. You know, I liked Gerald's theme this year of lean forward, because when I got to thinking about that for my keynote, mm-hmm. I was asking myself, well, so what does this mean? What does this mean to me? And I thought, you know, that's actually pretty relevant, because you can't lean forward without taking a step. Mm. And that's, if you don't take a step, you fall flat on your face, which is not what most of us want to do. So when you lean forward, it forces you to take a step. And that step can either stop your fall and just be one step just to break you, or it can be a step that leads to another step, and then another step, and then another step. And you just keep leaning forward in that direction and just keep moving. So to me, the way to stay relevant is just by taking another step. It almost doesn't matter what direction you head. You have to decide what's important to you, what you want, which frankly is kind of where I find myself right now. Is I was texting with my daughter the other day about this, and she said, "Dad, you know, you could produce, you could direct, you could do, you've got that stuff in you." And I said, "Yeah, you know what? I probably do. And if I decided that that's what I wanted, I could probably go in that direction and make it happen. The problem is, I don't know that that's what I want. I got to figure out what I want." But then once you figure out what you want and you lean forward and you go in that direction, you just don't stop taking another step, which has really sort of become my mantra lately, is never stop taking another step.
Never stop taking another step.
Because once you stop taking another step, you're like, I mean, unless it's for a break, to gather yourself and to sort of, you know, center and pull your pieces together, your person together, to kind of figure out what you want and which direction you want to go, then take another step. But once you stop taking another step because you just don't have it in you anymore, well, then you're done, you know, and you got to accept that. You go, okay, well, I'm done. And then find contentment in that, because contentment to me is everything. You know, to be always seeking and searching and wanting and wishing, just keeps us in a place of never landing, and you know what I mean. And I don't like that. It's I want to be in a place of contentment where I can be content no matter what. And it may not be what I wanted, you know. And listen, I'm a big believer in God. So you know, sort of the broad answer for me as a believer is to say to you, well, listen, I think God had a lot to do with the orchestrating of my life and my career, you know. And there have been times when I've been, you know, really on track and really faithful and really listening to him. And there have been plenty of times when I haven't, when I just cut out on my own and said, no, this is what I want, you know. But I know in my gut that the contentment comes from him, because I know that if I believe, not that if I believe, but I believe that if I simply allow him to do what he wants to do in my life, I will know it. That's what faith is about, you know.
That knowing, right?
And I'll just know it, yeah. But there have been times when that knowing is the realization that, whoa, that's not quite what I wanted. You know, and God says, no, that's right. That's not what you had in mind, but it's what I have in mind for you. And when I can get to that point and I say to myself, dude, remember contentment, because you don't know what's around the next corner. So if you can be content with this, that is not what you wanted at all. You have the choice of either being anxious and angry and upset and bitter and resentful and all that stuff about this. But if you can find a place of contentment in that to replace all that other stuff and just be okay with it, my belief is that that's when God is going to give you the other stuff. Maybe not necessarily what you want, but the icing on the cake. Because I don't believe that we're going to get what we want until we're content with what we have.
Oh, amen, brother from another mother. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's about, because first of all, I'm not even sure if time exists. So, and with that, I feel like it's within this moment that if we fully, and I'm not saying I do this, but this is what right. I strive to do.
Right.
Fully be in this moment. And I believe that when you speak, where your heart and what you're connected to, that vibration comes through and is felt
absolutely.
On that level.
Absolutely. It's something about the way we're created that this communication is like just looking at you right now. You know, it's like there's very definitely a connection. We're made to connect with mm-hmm. people, and we've got all kinds of resources available to us that allow us to connect in different ways. The voice is one of them, you know, and so I believe that when we speak, the way we speak and the passion with which we speak and then the directness and the belief and the whatever it is, the centeredness, you know what I'm saying? It yeah. comes through. It comes
Absolutely.
Through. People hear that. Now, can you describe that? Can you define that? Not really well, I don't think, you know, but you know it when you hear it. Or you know it when you see it, or you
it
know
it
when
be
you feel it.
Manufactured, you know. I don't think it's something yeah. that can be like manufactured and manipulated. I think that when it comes from a place of authenticity, not to yep. try to get somewhere, but you're just yeah. there because you're there.
Yeah. You're just sharing you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I apply that to voiceover too. You know, it's like when I teach, and I don't teach often, but when I do, you know, one of the things that I try and get across is just be you. You know, don't try. You know, one of the hardest things for me at NBC that day and then for the ensuing months after that, when I first started back in 1993, was getting Danny Dark's voice out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Danny Dark was a huge influence for me. I loved that man and I was a huge fan of his. And just I had grown up basically as an adult, you know, in this business, listening to him as the voice of NBC. So every time I said NBC, I heard his voice echoing in my head, and I found myself early on trying to mimic him. And it was when I said, dude, don't do that. Danny is Danny and nobody will ever be Danny. You are you and nobody will ever be you. Find out who that is and what that is, and then go there and then push in that direction with this thing, this NBC specifically thing. And that's when it started to work. That's when it really started to work, I think. You know what I'm saying? So
absolutely. Yeah.
I wasn't trying to be somebody else because I was at first, and it was hard to break that. But once you get out of this notion that I have to sound like him or her or that thing, you miss the point of trying to sound like you. You know, it's like, what would you do with this if nobody told you, if you didn't have all these specs saying we're looking for a such and such type? You know, what if you, okay, go ahead and do that, but what if you just ignore the specs at the bottom of the script and you say, well, I'm liking these words, what would I do with these words?
Yeah.
And it may come, something completely different may come out than the specs are looking for. But I always think that that's a great take to send.
Yeah. I love that. So my last question for you, Maya Angelou says,
okay.
Words mean more.
Words mean more. Yeah. Go ahead.
Then what is
words
set,
mean more.
Then what is set down on paper.
Yep.
It takes the human voice to infuse them with deeper meaning.
Yep.
What do you hope your overall voice conveys in life and work?
I would hope that, you know, I'm all about kindness. And I see so little of it in the world today. And I just think kindness matters. I really do. I think civility matters. I think, and as mushy and cliche as it sounds, but I think love matters. I think caring matters. So these are the kinds of things that I would hope that my voice, not only the sound of my voice, but the things that I say would convey. That's the stuff I want people to be left with when they walk away from some time with me, is that I've looked them in the eye and that I am present and that I take care of listening to them. I just think that that's really, really, really important, especially today, because it just seems like there's so little of it. Everybody's,
I thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Of course. Tina, you've been delightful. I really appreciate this. Thanks.
Thanks for listening in. Please tune in next week, where next week's episode is the big, wait for it, 5-0. I have a personal and magical story I want to share with you. Until next time, here's to owning our voices.